When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod. Listeners, I want to remind you that if you love podcasts, and even if you're merely indifferent to them, you still won't want to miss Now Hear This, a podcasting festival coming to LA this October. We'll be there for a live Dear Prudence on Saturday, October 29th, with all of the live and on-stage advice you could possibly want. You can see me live on stage, as well as more shows that you love, like The Canon, Comedy Bang Bang, Dinner Party Download, The Gist, Marc Maron, and The Moth. Step up to a VIP pass for meet and greets with your favorite hosts. Presumably this includes me. Sit up close in reserved seating, hang out in the VIP lounge, and more special perks. Tickets are on sale now for Now Hear This, October 28th through the 30th in Anaheim, California, just a short drive from Los Angeles. Get tickets and see the whole lineup at nowhearthisfest.com.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudy, do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Help.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Dear Prudence podcast. Once again, and for always, I am your host, Dear Prudence, also known as Mallory Ortberg, and I've got some exciting surprises for you this week in the studio. In the meantime, I'd like to address something that I've seen popping up in a lot of letters lately, which is someone will write to me and they'll say, a person I know, someone in my family, someone I work with, a friend of a friend, says these things to me all the time, and they really hurt my feelings. They're about my appearance, or about my race, or about my age, or about my earning potential, and they're really mean and passive-aggressive and constant. It doesn't stop. And I've tried to talk about it with my boss, my partner, my girlfriend, my boyfriend, my mom. And whenever I ask someone else about it, they always say, well, they don't really mean it. And I find that excuse so interesting because the question is, why is this person always saying this mean thing about me over and over again? And the answer is, they don't mean the thing they keep saying. Which, we don't act like that in any other part of our lives. If someone keeps talking about a trip they're really excited to take to Seville, people don't say, well, obviously, Brendan is never going to Seville. He's just saying he'd like to go to Seville. Like, we live in a society where, you know, by common consent, we assume that language means the things we want it to mean. So while someone might occasionally have a slip of the tongue or as a one-off say something and then later apologize and say, I didn't really mean that, I just wanted to hurt you or I was confused or mistaken. But if someone repeatedly says things over and over again, you can generally take it for granted that they're saying it because they mean it. So if you ask someone, why does Trevington always say that I'm a bad person, and they say they don't mean it. He does. He does mean that you're a bad person, and you get to talk about it. It makes no sense to try to dismiss a complaint by saying someone doesn't mean the thing they say on purpose over and over again. People generally mean the things they say, especially when they say it repeatedly. So that's just a little general advice from me to you. And with that in mind, I'd like to introduce you to the very special guest we have in studio with us today, Laura Turner. Some special facts about Laura Turner are that I have lived with her my whole life. We have the same father. We have the same mother. And we have the same brother. She's my sister, ladies and gentlemen. Please welcome her to the studio.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm trying to think of if there's anything else that I need to let the audience at home know about you.
I can help you out on that score.
Please enlighten us.
I think the most important thing they need to know is that when I was 10 years old, I was building a snow fort in the middle of the cul-de-sac. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
At least. And my neighbor, Alex, this Ukrainian boy who lived next door to us, was kind of the object of my affection. And I had built this snow fort hoping that he would come out and we could play together. And I was envisioning this very like serendipity romantic comedy.
I don't think I ever knew, by the way, that you built the snow fort with the object of like attracting him.
Would it have changed your actions? Because then, dear reader, she crushed it.
I don't remember why, but we got in a fight and I went out after you had gone to bed and I smashed your whole snow fort.
Smashed good. I never did marry Alex, though.
I destroyed your fortress of solitude. No, I had no idea. I thought it was just this snow fort you had built for yourself. And now I'm disappointed to learn that it was all to ensnare a boy.
Yeah, it was.
I think less of you.
Well, things turned out for the best.
I would destroy it again if I had the chance.
Jeez.
Something that you should know about Laura is that she routinely attempted to scare my younger brother and me by, if our parents were coming home late, she would like come downstairs and say, guys, I just found a note from mom that says she's leaving us. She just doesn't ever want to come home. And we'd like look at this little post-it and what was clearly Laura's handwriting that just said, John, I don't love you or the children anymore. Goodbye. And we'd think, that's probably not mom. That doesn't sound like her. But what if it is? And we would worry until she came home.
I had a career in trolling early in life before Twitter even existed.
We clearly both trolled the shit out of one another.
It worked out well. Trolling can build relationships, I think, is the moral of the story.
So in that vein, let's start with our first letter, the subject line of which is texting the news that a loved one has died.
Not a good way to start.
All right. Please don't interrupt me while I read this letter.
Oh, fine.
Dear Prudence. I found out that my great-grandmother died from my half-sister tagging me in a group photo with her and the words RIP in the caption. About 2 years ago, my father, who I never knew growing up, and with whom I'm on a friendly but not close basis, texted me, "Your grandmother has a brain tumor. It looks like she's going to die soon." She lived for another year and a half, and my aunt called me when she passed, but shortly thereafter, my half-sister texted me to let me know my grandmother was dead. I'm thinking about this now because I spoke to a client today whose mother passed away and who found out via text message. So I'm clearly not the only one who's found out about a loved one's passing in this way. I'm hoping you could help me come up with a sensitive way to explain to my father and half-sister that I really need to be called when a loved one passes, even though we don't have regular conversations and our communication is tenuous. I understand that it's a difficult conversation to have, and even more so when you have to call someone you're not very close with. Finding out about a serious illness or death of a loved one from a text message is extremely hurtful and devastating to me. Sadly, we have other loved ones who are aging, and this behavior seems doomed to repeat itself.
Yikes. Well, the first thing I want to say is if you are someone in possession of the knowledge that a close family member is about to die and you are communicating that information, don't do it in a text message if you can avoid that option. It is tempting to do so, and it can seem expedient, but expedience may not be the priority in a case like this. So if you're on that side of things, you might want to think twice about making a phone call.
Yeah. I think it's especially rough to find out someone has passed by finding that you have been tagged in a group photograph with them that says RIP.
Yeah.
That's harsh.
That is a way you couldn't find out, in fact, until recently. So this is one of those cases in which technology is not doing us any favors. But it's also, I think, a good idea to think about if there are other people in your family who you might be able to communicate with about something like this. Is there another sibling, an uncle, an aunt who handles this news or communicates in a way that you recognize is helpful that you could ask, hey, in the future, can you keep a heads up for me in this kind of situation?
Mm-hmm. But I do think if this is something that you would want specifically from your half-sister and your father, this will require you to make a call.
Mm-hmm.
I think you cannot text them this request. Like, you have to make it clear that you are willing to pick up the phone and have the occasional challenging conversation and just say, you know, you can have a brief, like, how you doing? Hey, I just wanted to say, I know that when the last two people in the family died, you texted me, and I would just love to ask if you could call me, just because sometimes that's hard news to receive over text. And be prepared. They might say, oh, I'll try. And then they might text you anyways. I think it's a totally fair request to make. It might not be something that you would want to pursue a fight about if they did not honor your request, especially since you're not really close. Like, make the ask, but then if they don't do it in the future, this might be something you have to live with, especially since you're not close with one another, and you're not interested in starting a fight with that, because that could be really...
That would not be a pleasant fight. Not the fights are pleasant, but that would be a difficult thing to get into an argument about. And I think I remember finding out about a friend of mine when I was younger who died via text message. And that was awful and sad. But I think partly what I needed to realize is that the people who were in the position of sharing that news had a lot on their plates. They didn't do the best job they could. And it's well worth having this conversation. But in whatever way is appropriate, try to have some empathy for their position, too.
That's really true, because nobody who is, like, responsible for disseminating the information that someone is dead is, like, having a great time.
No, it's not a good task.
They're probably feeling emotional. They might not feel up to making a call. So, again, it's a totally fair request for you to make. I think it's better to call whenever possible. But do also try to extend them a little empathy, because that's, you know, it's presumably hard to call someone you're semi-estranged from and say, like, someone we love has just died. But yeah, try not to tag group photograph. That's rough.
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
Let's draw the line there.
Maybe just don't use Facebook.
Yeah.
Don't use Facebook for important end-of-life announcements.
Yeah, I can't imagine finding out someone I cared about died over Facebook.
No, that would just be real hard.
Really rough.
Yeah.
Okay. And hopefully in the future when people you love die, you'll be able to find out via phone.
Yeah, but
that's like my wish for you, but yeah.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit 1 million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.
All right, which brings us to the next letter, which is sort of the opposite problem. There's too many people who are alive.
Wow.
That's not the problem at all.
The world.
That's not the problem.
Too
I have
many people.
Misrepresented the problem at hand. It's just about having to take care of a lot of children, which I think of as the sort of opposite of losing elderly relatives.
In a way.
Anyhow.
Let's in a just, world.
Let's just get to the letter. Dear Prudence, my husband and I bought a house a year ago, and he's finishing up his master's this year. I've been promoted at work, which means a nice bump in pay and a whole lot more vacation time. Everything has fallen nicely into place. I wish this was the end of the letter.
Oh, this was such a hard one.
It is not.
No.
We have started talking about trying to get pregnant in the near future. Then we were contacted by CPS. My husband's youngest sister is facing drug and child neglect charges. The landlord called the cops after serving an eviction notice for failure to pay rent. Her children had been left alone for more than a week in the house with only the 13-year-old watching them. According to the cops, my sister-in-law had repeatedly left them alone during the entire summer. None of the neighbors noticed those kids living alone for days at a time with no adult in sight. We live an hour and a half away, which was closer than any other relatives, so we've taken them all in. We're now scrambling to get them enrolled in school and make sure they're taken care of. Now there are 5 children, aged 3 to 13, living with us now. This has been a nightmare for everyone involved. Honestly, I find myself driving home from work taking the long way because it's the only time I get any peace. Home is nothing but stress, noise, and destruction. My 8-year-old nephew puts holes in the walls, and his younger brother has tantrums that last for hours. My husband keeps telling me that this will pass, but that's a bald-faced lie. My sister-in-law is facing felony drug charges. Realistically, she's going to be locked up for more than a few years. His family has made comments about wanting to keep the kids together. My in-laws live 5 hours south of us, and the rest live out of state. I can't take on 5 children permanently. I don't want to. I feel resentful and bitter that the future I have worked so hard for has been stolen. Then I feel ashamed and guilty. My nieces and nephews have been through hell. I have only spoken to my parents about this. I feel trapped. If it was only the 2 older girls, or just the toddler, I wouldn't hesitate to keep them. But I can't take all 5 in. How do I start this conversation with my husband?
Oh, girl.
How I long for the
days of I would like a phone call when someone dies.
Don't tell me over Facebook.
Oh, man. Yeah. I feel so much sympathy for this woman.
Gosh, absolutely. And one of the things that I wanted to say is taking the long road home after work is totally acceptable right now. Keep doing it.
Yeah, if that's your outlet, that is healthy and doesn't hurt anyone.
I do it sometimes when I just have to go home to my husband and my dog. So go for it.
I do it sometimes, too, and I don't even have anything.
Yeah.
It's not true. I have a dog.
You have nothing.
I don't even have friends.
Nothing.
I just live in a vacuum.
It's very sad.
And I still try to avoid it. That is a healthy coping strategy that
totally.
You've got going on. So don't beat yourself up for that.
The emotional, every dynamic in this is so complicated. Emotional, logistically, physically, where are they all staying? It just sounds so difficult. So the first thing I would say is give yourself a lot of grace or patience or whatever you think you need right now. You're not in a situation that's going to resolve overnight, and you're not in a situation that's going to resolve with a silver bullet. There are going to be a lot of hard conversations to have in the next few weeks for you and your family.
Yeah. And I one thing I really appreciate that this letter writer says is she obviously is discussing the things that are really hard for her, but she also acknowledges these kids have been through hell.
Mm-hmm.
And she's aware. And that just makes me reassured. You are clearly a nurturing and an understanding and an empathetic person that you can acknowledge. That this 8-year-old is not putting holes in your walls because he's a jerk. He's doing it because he's traumatized and he has no better way of expressing how he feels.
Yeah, absolutely. And think of, what that 8-year-old has gone through is heartbreaking. And you are clearly someone who can understand that and empathize with it. And at the same time, recognize that doesn't mean that you need to take on responsibility for these 5 kids.
Right. I think you're absolutely right that you do need to start this conversation with your husband, because he might just be in this mode right now of this is my sister. She's going to go to jail. My only job is to keep her kids together, step up. I don't have the option of doing anything else. And you absolutely need to have a conversation with him that's just really honest, that leaves all your options on the table and just lets him know what you are and are not capable of, because you do have options. Because this looks like it's going to be a long-term plan, if you guys talk about what would it look like if for a while, one of our other relatives took in a couple of the kids, not forever, not let's split up the family, but would it be an option for a few months at a time for them to take one of the kids, maybe one of the kids who seems like they're doing well, or one of the kids who they can kind of have the most rapport with to just help you not feel like you're going to go bananas.
Yeah. I think one of the most hard positions in life is to be in a space where you feel like your back's up against the wall and there's nothing you can do.
Right.
There's no other way out. And in this situation, I'm sure you feel that intensely, and you do have options. Mm-hmm. You could talk with your other relatives who live far away and say what Mallory suggested for a month at a time. Can you look into helping out with the kids? You can have them come stay with you somewhere nearby and have the kids stay with them. You can talk with your parents about helping out and pitching in.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you probably need to revisit with your husband, what does your little family look like? The two of you, your new house, your plans for having kids. Are those plans you can put on hold for now? Do you feel okay about that? Are those plans you want to get going on? You need to not lose sight in the middle of this of what it is that you two have built together and what you're hoping for the future. And you have to look at that in conjunction with your situation now.
Yeah. And I think you got to call a big family meeting.
Yeah.
With the in-laws who live 5 hours south of you and the family that's out of state. And maybe that's going to be a meeting that takes place partly over the phone. But you need to all be either physically in the same room or on the phone saying what can everyone do? What's the most everyone can commit? And what are our options? Because I think one thing that would be a really bad outcome would be because they all live further away and you're the closest and the kids live with you now, for everyone else to say, the problem's taken care of. You guys can just handle this, right? And for you to feel like you're going crazy and you're way in over your head and you're resentful and you're guilty and you're anguished. You need to have a really big, open, honest family conversation.
Yeah.
And it's possible your in-laws live 5 hours south of you. Kids can move 5 hours. If to the rest of the family, it's no, our kids have to stay together. Then ask them if they're willing to open their home to 5 children.
Yeah. Yeah. The situation here is not such that the only option is to keep the five kids together under your roof. That would be, you would be superhuman, I think, if you were able overnight to welcome in, you know, your five nieces and nephews to live with you for an indefinite period of time. And I would also recommend, if your sister-in-law has an attorney or someone who's walking her through this process, just be in touch with them regularly. Mm. Get the best information you can on what she's doing and what realistically her situation looks like. It may not be that she's going to be out soon, but if she can have contact with her kids, if other members of your family can facilitate that so they don't lose the relationship they have with their mom, you know, that's going to be part of the equation for these five kids, too.
Right. And I think another thing that you should do absolutely in the short term is, like, get therapy for these kids.
Yeah.
Because these children have been, at best, neglected repeatedly.
Yeah.
There's possibly way more going on than you're aware of. Like, clearly they are dealing with stress and trauma that they cannot process in, like, appropriate ways. And they need a lot of help. And they need to be in therapy, like, probably for a while.
Yeah, and look into, like, local, I know there are, like, court-appointed special advocate programs.
Right.
There are places where you can get resources for little to no money with your local county, most likely. So check into local options for places that aren't going to be private therapy as well.
Right. For people who are used to, for people who are used to helping people who are taking in family members, like, this is something that happens often when people are imprisoned. Like, you are not alone. You are not the first person who has, like, unexpectedly had to take in children. And, like, I would just, yeah, find out every resource that you can get and make sure that you're getting therapy, too.
Yeah.
I think that's a non-negotiable. It might feel like, on top of everything else, another thing to do. But, like, you need somewhere safe that you can express resentment of these kids, because you can't do that to them. They are children who did not ask to be put in this situation. But you need to have some place where you can go and say, I feel overwhelmed. I can't do this. I resent an 8-year-old. I resent a 5-year-old. I want my old life back. And to figure out ways to deal with that and ways to find the best possible outcome for all of you guys.
Yeah. And back to sort of the question at the very end of your letter, how do you start the conversation with your husband? I think the sooner the better, and with a lot of understanding for the position he's in. But don't make any assumptions. Don't think he's going to want to have them forever. He needs to do this. Just ask him, honestly, what does he want and what is he prepared to do? And then talk with him about what you're prepared to do, even if those are two very different things. Mm-hmm. You've got to start somewhere. You can't wait until you think you're both on the same page. This is way too important.
And this is a conversation to have before that sort of big family meeting so that the two of you can go in at least with the information about what the other one wants. Because it may be that your husband also feels similarly and or at least more similarly than you thought. And, like, it will help to be very, very honest with one another about what you can and can't do.
Yeah. But, man, keep taking that long road home.
Yeah.
Get Billy Joel or Celine Dion or whoever does it for you and just do what you need to do on that drive home.
Yeah. Yeah. Make sure that every day you have at least a couple of minutes to yourself. Because you you have a lot of responsibilities right now that you did not expect would be coming your way. And you need to take
and
care of yourself.
Burnout is a real possibility for you real fast down this road. So the small things you can do to get a moment of silence are going to be good.
Yeah. Okay. Laura, I'm going to have you read this next one.
All right. The subject of this letter is a writer's block. And the letter writer says, I guess this issue is twofold. Number one, Stella and I have known each other since we were 14. We are best friends, yah-yah sisterhood style. We have been through everything together. We speak our own language, traveled to strange cities, watched sunrises, helped each other break up with dumb boyfriends. Number two, I am now a nearly 30-year-old writer-filmmaker. Stella and I grew up both dreaming of becoming working writers. We workshopped each other's projects all through undergrad and onward. We celebrated successes, and we drank wine and burned rejection letters. After college, she opted to stay in academics, where she remains as a PhD candidate. I went straight into the workforce and began publishing. Last year, my first film was optioned and released by a major production house. Everyone in my professional and personal life has been amazingly supportive, and I've found this past year to be incredibly positive. The only thorn in my side is Stella. She won't mention anything about it. Her husband came to screenings, but she acts as though it doesn't exist. I don't need the validation, and I'm not angry. I don't care if she hasn't seen it. I don't care if she saw the movie and hated it. That's something we'd be able to laugh at together. What I do feel is that it's a curious omission, and it is driving a bizarre wedge between what was once a magical and unbreakable friendship. With anyone else in my life, I wouldn't really think about it, but I am fixed on this since we have always supported each other in our dreams of working as creatives. My fiancé says to talk to her, but I need Prudy's outside perspective. I don't want to scold her. I just want to understand if her silence is deliberate or if she is dealing with her own fears right now. Other than this gorilla-sized DVD in the room, our relationship is totally great and there is no other notable tension. I don't want to look up one day and realize we aren't friends anymore because I didn't have the courage to bring up something so silly and wholly unrelated to all we have been through together.
Bro, just bring it up.
Do it.
This is going to be a 5-minute conversation.
This isn't silly. And your friendship probably wasn't magical. I think in some ways it sounds like the letter writer might have expectations that their friendship will always continue to be this
magically
sort of
supportive,
perfect gem of a friendship.
Free
and nothing
from insecurity and jealousy.
Rock the boat. Yeah, especially if you've chosen to go down similar creative paths. Sometimes friendships get competitive and that sucks and it shouldn't be the case, but you're never going to be able to have an honest friendship if you don't talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, if you think that this friendship is unbreakable, then it can definitely survive a conversation where you say, hey, last year I had a movie come out and we've never discussed it. That makes me feel weird.
And then she would say, oh, right. I felt a little jealous and I feel weird that I haven't talked to you about it.
Right. Or she'll say, I don't want to talk about it. And you'll figure out how to respond to that. Or she'll say, I haven't known how to say this. I saw it and I didn't like it. And
totally.
Like you said, you guys can laugh about it. Like that moment in 30 Rock where Liz flashes back and realizes that she's always been negging Jenna's performances without realizing it.
The lighting was so good.
Ethan and I both thought the programs were really easy to read. Yeah, I mean, this is just a conversation where, like, you have all the power to fix your situation. Open your mouth.
Yeah.
Like, find the courage. Do whatever you have to do. Like, play the Rocky theme song. Pump yourself up. And then just, like, go see your friend and say, hey, I had a movie come out last year. We've never discussed it. It makes me feel weird. I would rather know that you, like, didn't like it or were uncomfortable with me or were mad at me about something or whatever than just feel like this was some, you know, topic we could not talk about.
Totally. And in the future, considering that you guys have both achieved some level of success early on in your careers, this is probably only going to become more of an issue, whether you do other movies or she publishes something really prestigious in her academic world.
Right.
It's going to be really fantastic to have a friend who will be happy with you. So even if she's happy and doesn't like your movie or doesn't want to see it, that's going to be really different than just not talking about it
right.
and making you wonder, what's up?
I mean, yeah, maybe you'll talk to her and she'll say, yeah, you know, I never knew how to bring it up. I've lately felt like you never asked me how my work is going.
Mm-hmm.
So it made me not want to ask you. And then you guys can, like, be vulnerable together and say, we, like, haven't been taking as good enough care of each other as we wanted to. But
totally,
literally the only way you're going to get any information is by just saying it. And, like, you can acknowledge that you feel a little silly about it. You can say, this is not a huge deal. I care about you way more than some stupid movie that I made. Not that it's stupid, but
no,
just like you're so much more important to me. But I want to be able to have this conversation.
One thing that's kind of silly that my husband and I actually do in conflict is we'll use a rating system like 1 through 10. And it feels really goofy to say and oddly formal. But if I'm bringing up like, hey, this is like a 3, but the last 3 weeks you said you take the trash out and it hasn't been done and I've done it.
Yeah.
And it makes me feel a little bit like I'm responsible for everything around the house. So I don't know. Maybe that's not helpful. But if it is, this doesn't have to be let's sit down and have a capital S serious discussion. It can just be, hey, this is a 3 or 4, but I'm feeling a little sad about not having acknowledged this big part of my life. Let's talk about that.
Right. And I think the longer you wait, the higher up the scale it's going to go. Because it's clear that she's not going to bring it up. She's fine with the silence, or at least willing to pretend to be fine with the silence. And you're going to feel way weirder if 10 years from now you're like, we never talked about this and it's been a decade. There are, you know, talk about it now. Talk about it now. Just open your mouth and say, we've never talked about my movie and that makes me a little bit sad. Can we talk about it?
Talk about it now is a good tattoo to get if you're looking for one.
Or just write it down, frankly.
No, tattoo it on your skin.
Sure. There's never been a better time to sign up for Slate Plus. If you thought there was, you were mistaken. For Slate's 20th anniversary, for a limited time, we're offering 30% off an annual membership. That's just $35 for an entire year of Slate Plus, with bonus segments of this and other Slate podcasts every week, and a lot more. So if you haven't joined Plus yet, sign up before this offer goes away at slate.com/prudypod. All right, I'm going to read the next letter, which is, my daughter is my smoking companion. Oh, yeah, this is about cigarettes. I wanted to clarify before I started because I wasn't sure. Sometimes people just say smokes when they mean pot, and I never know which one.
Like Kyle Mooney.
But this one is, they say cigarettes, so right. It's about cigarettes. Dear Prudence, my 18-year-old daughter recently admitted to me that she smokes. For her sake, I was disappointed, but I was happy to have someone to smoke with. We've smoked together for a few weeks now, and it's been companionable. The other day, she asked me for a cigarette since hers were gone. I gave her a whole pack. My husband found out, and he said I was making it easier for our daughter to smoke. I got defensive, but now I have a terrible feeling that he was right. I definitely won't restock her cigarette supply again, but I suppose that I would give her one cigarette if she asked. Do you think that could worsen her habit? In my heart, I want my daughter to quit before she's totally addicted, but I really enjoy smoking with her.
Oh, buddies.
Yeah.
Ugh, this is a conversation that I think you already know exactly how to have, and you don't want to.
I also would like to point out that step one should be to apologize to your husband.
Yeah.
Because you say you got defensive, but now you think that he was right, which means that the next step is not make some quiet internal decision about how many cigarettes you're going to give your daughter, but go to your husband and say, hey, I'm really sorry I got so defensive. You were right and I was wrong.
Which are hard words to say, but I think you'll feel a lot better once you do.
Apologies are great. They're not everything, but they're great. And you know that you reacted badly to his, like, pretty reasonable suggestion.
So in this situation, too, there's something that a dynamic where you, as the letter writer and the mom, are still this girl's mom. And, you know, you say you feel disappointed for her sake, but the sentence doesn't end there. You are happy to have someone to smoke with. It's understandable to be happy to have someone to smoke with. But when you are the parent, one of your jobs, even as the kids get older, is to look out for them and love them and care for them. And this is something that's damaging for both of you. It's not the end of the world. It's not the worst thing ever. You're not the worst mom ever. So you don't need to go down the road of feeling overly guilty. But when your daughter comes to you and says that she's smoking cigarettes regularly, it would be great to encourage her gently not to smoke. And even better if it could come from a mom who doesn't smoke.
It's also really telling that your daughter asked you for one cigarette and you gave her a whole pack.
Yeah.
Like, there's a dynamic there that I think is a little bit... I think you're lying to yourself a little bit more than you think you are, which is way more than you want your daughter to quit. You want her to be your smoking buddy. Like, you gave your daughter a pack when she asked for one. And then you ask later, do you think that could worsen her habit? Yeah. The only thing that worsens smoking is smoking. And by giving someone a packet of cigarettes when they asked for one, like, by definition, you are encouraging them to ramp up. So I think... another thing you have to do is be super honest with yourself and admit, like, there is a part of me that's really strong that wants my daughter to be my smoking buddy. It makes me feel close to her.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me feel like I'm not alone. It makes me feel like, fill in the blank, figure out what it is that it makes you feel, and then ask yourself, is this worth helping my daughter become a lifelong smoker?
Yeah. And I think that you say at the end of the letter, you don't want your daughter to get addicted, but it's entirely likely that she already is. I mean, she's at an age where she's making decisions for herself as an adult at 18, and she's coming to you for cigarettes. And part of her must know at some level that you are happy about this.
I mean, this is like the old commercial, right? Like, I learned it from watching you.
Totally.
Like, she probably learned it from watching you.
Yeah. And again, like, going down the road of beating yourself up isn't necessarily something that's going to be helpful right here. But this could be a really good opportunity for you as a mom, as Mallory said, to be really honest with yourself,
mm-hmm.
and to think about, what are the ways that you've shown your daughter, not just that smoking is okay, but that the way she gets to closeness with you is to do the things that you like to do.
Right. Like, find another way to be companionable with your daughter.
Totally. There are lots more appropriate ways, lots more fun ways.
Yep.
Go to movies.
Or just, like, you can just sit outside with her and talk.
Yeah.
I think you do need to. I mean, like, I would encourage you to try quitting. Believe me, I know how hard quitting is. I think part of what made me want to read this letter with you is, like, you know, as you know, like, I started smoking cigarettes when I was 16.
I do know that.
And I've quit many times in my life, often mm-hmm. for long stretches at a time, sometimes for years. And, like, one of the things that I have noticed is whenever I pick it back up, I smoke a lot more than I did the last time around. Mm-hmm. And I don't like that. Like, yeah. That really scares me.
Yeah, and I would imagine it, like you said, it only gets easier the more you smoke. You
totally.
Know, a habit begets a habit.
Yep. No, and I also totally understand, like, if I'm in the process of quitting and I'm with a friend who smokes a lot and they offer me a cigarette, it's so easy to say yes. It is fun. It is sociable. Like, you do meet great people smoking cigarettes a lot of the time. You have great conversations. But so, like, I get that. I really, really do. And like, yesterday was my first day without a cigarette, and today is day two.
Yay.
And it's rough. I get it. And especially if somebody I wanted to be closer with said, do you want a cigarette or can I have a cigarette? It would be really hard to say no. And I understand that, like, when you're addicted to smoking, sometimes you make decisions that you think, that's not what I want to be. That's not the kind of person I want to be. But it's so hard to say no. So, like, I extend to you a lot of sympathy, but I really, really, like, I just feel really strongly, like, I would feel so uncomfortable if, like, a young person, especially a child, was, like, asking me for cigarettes. Like, I couldn't.
Yeah.
I think that's not a path you should go down.
Important here that she's 18. She's just starting, it sounds like. And right now, the encouragement that you're giving her could spark and lead to a years-long or lifelong addiction on her part. And I do want to say one thing that I think is really great here is that you've got an 18-year-old daughter who likes to spend time with you. And that's not always the case.
Yeah.
So take that while you're thinking about all of this and kind of getting really, really honest with yourself about your motivations, and think about the ways that you can have her as a companion that might not involve smoking, whether it's doing something together or just hanging out and having a conversation outside, enjoying her company. That's not something every mom gets when they have an 18-year-old daughter. And that's really great. You're doing something right in all of this. So find out what that is, too, and keep that up.
Yeah. And I think just my final note on this is just that, like, smoking limits your options. Not always immediately, but over time, it limits your options. It can limit your options by harming your health. It can limit your options, like, you get a lot of head colds. It can limit your options, like, you can't go a certain amount of time without a cigarette. And, like, over time, it can limit your options by making you die, like, 20, 25 years earlier than you might have. And, like, as a parent, it is your job to give your child as many options as possible, especially at 18.
Yeah.
Like, don't give her a pack of cigarettes, man. Like,
you don't need to do it.
Do not, like, chain her to that same, like, monkey that you're chained to right now. Like, that's not, don't give her that. Like, I very much would love to, like, go back in time to the 16-year-old who was like, this is fine and casual, and be like, no, it's going to get so much harder.
Yeah.
Like, it just gets harder every time. I thought I was so good at quitting smoking when I quit for the first time at 22.
Mm-hmm.
And then I quit again at 24, and then again at 26, and then again at 27. And, like,
yeah,
it gets harder every time.
That totally makes sense. Any habit that you get into more and more as time goes on, it gets harder. It's just difficult and sad and awful. And you are her mom and you love her so much and you want her to have a good and long life. So don't let this be about you getting the companionship that you want from your daughter by trading her a pack of cigarettes for an hour together. That's not worth it. And I think you know that.
Yep. I think you do, too. I think you do, too. And I have a lot of hope for you that you can make better choices. I know it will be difficult. I encourage you to enlist your husband's support. It sounds
like
he is, like, trying to make you be your best self. And I think if you apologize to him and ask for his help, say, like, I'm so sorry, I don't want to do this. I love our daughter. I love you. Thank you for looking out for me. Can you help me? And, like, yeah. At the bare minimum, do not give your daughter more cigarettes. Beyond that, I would say, if you are going to continue to smoke, don't smoke with her. Because I think that will just make it easier over time to give her cigarettes again. And I would also encourage you to look into ways to quit, because it's good to quit smoking cigarettes.
Yeah. And you're not in it alone. It sounds like your husband is maybe someone who can help you with this. Talk to friends who have done it. Look up resources online if that's something you're interested in. I think you can do this.
Yep. Laura, I feel like we have just, like, fixed everyone's problems.
Well, you know, I think we're pretty good at this. Uh-huh. It's in our DNA.
I'm sorry that I destroyed your snow fort and your chances with Alex.
Thank you. And Alex, wherever you are, you know, call me.
That's... This is inappropriate.
Don't call me. I'm happily married.
Yeah, yeah.
But I hope you're doing great.
I do too. Oh, Laura, you might want to stay for my closing riff.
I do. Well, what is it about?
Have you finished Stranger Things yet?
Yes, I finished it last night.
Okay, these are not going to be heavy spoilers. These are light to moderate spoilers about relationships. So if you don't want spoilers on Stranger Things, stop listening to the show.
Don't make that voice. It was legit better without spoilers.
What a begrudging concession that was to spoiler alerts.
True.
I wish you joy. I normally love spoilers. I usually will go out of my way to find spoilers before I watch something. And Stranger Things was like an actual exception for me.
It was so good that it's, I think that's a testament to it.
At any rate, I want to say two things about Stranger Things, one of which was, you know, I was born in the mid to late 80s, as were you.
Mm-hmm.
So we did not so much live through the 80s
no.
as we did sort of just like...
Existed.
Yeah, we were around, but we weren't
vaguely
like participating.
Aware.
We weren't cultural movers and shakers.
No, we weren't.
And I watched it with a member of Generation X who did very much live through the 80s.
Right.
And as we were watching it, I was like, I really like the show. I like all the characters. I feel like everyone's got nuance and layers, except for these like damn bullies who are so over the top. So like they don't have any outside interest. They don't ever talk about anything. All they do is like saunter around school saying things like, well, who do we have here? And just like they just go looking for trouble.
They
like,
literally tripped one of the kids.
Like, I know.
Stuck a
it's
foot
like,
out.
Have a nice trip. They were so ridiculous. And I was like, this is no one's ever talked like this in the history of time. This is bullshit. I was a kid once. No one ever acted this way. And my viewing companion was just like, this is 100% what everyone was like in the 80s. This is how all bullies operated. It was always just like, well, who do we have here? And
that's so wild. I don't know that world.
I was going to say, do you know anyone who was more alive in the 80s than us who can confirm this theory?
I don't know anyone who is more alive in the... I don't know anyone who's
well,
older than
Mom and Dad
me.
Were alive in the 80s, but they weren't really getting bullied.
They were kind of busy with us.
They were young parents.
Yeah, the thing that the Stranger Things bullies brought to mind were the bullies from the movie A Christmas Story, which was set in like the 1950s.
The
30s.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because they only had radio, not TV.
But it was made in the 80s, I believe.
It was.
So it felt like that. Also, obviously, the Kiefer Sutherland bully gang in Stand By Me.
I just like in the 80s, just like there was no nuance, apparently.
No
self-awareness.
That was really back in the day when a bully was a bully.
It was like apparently it was all you did.
It was a bully's golden age.
And they like really escalated. They went from like, oh, we're going to yell at you after school to like, I'm going to make you throw yourself into a quarry.
Yeah, that was some crazy stuff.
Yeah, those kids went from 0 to 60.
They did, but I kind of have to respect that. Like, they really stuck to the bully thing.
Yeah, so this is just my request. Anyone who was, like, more aware and sentient in the 80s than I was, please let me know. Were you bullied? Were you a bully? Did you see bullies? And if so, did Stranger Things accurately represent the 1980s bullying experience?
Yeah, what was bullying culture like in the 1980s?
Like, I remember, like, there were some kids who were meaner at school. I don't know that there was anybody who was like all day, every day, just like storming around the schoolyard,
yeah.
being a jerk.
And I feel like I feel like that would have been an experience of childhood I would have not liked to have, but have been interested to see, like someone who was just pure meanie.
Yeah, I don't like nobody was mean all the time.
No,
even like the girl in my class who I thought was kind of stuck up, like let me use her pen once, you know?
Yeah.
She had depth.
She had nuance.
She did.
These bullies don't.
No. She never tried to make me throw myself off a quarry. And I've always admired her for that.
But you know what they do have in common is their moms are always totally on their side.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. I love the trope of the bully's mom.
The bully's mom always 100% believes the bully.
Just like, my son would never do that. And then the bully always like has that look on his face of like, yeah, like I'm hiding behind my mom. What are you going to do
he
about
was
it?
Totally getting away with it. And his mom was probably like the high school prom queen or something.
She was a real piece of work.
Yeah, the
she
female
was a real
bully
work piece
in the wild.
Yeah,
work piece.
All right, so please flood us with your experiences of bullying in the 80s.
Mm.
Okay, that's it for us. Goodbye again, Laura. For real. Please leave the studio and go home.
Goodbye forever.
I love you very much.
Love you too.
Bye.
Thanks very much for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Casey Miner. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Steve Lichtai is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply. Remember, you can always hear more Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/plus to sign up. If you like this show, please go to iTunes and write us a review. Reviews extend your lifespan and help new listeners find the podcast, which means more questions and more advice. Just search for Slate Dear Prudence. I'd love to answer your question. Call me and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR. That's 3327. And you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location. And at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it to 30 seconds or a minute, and then send it to me at prudencepodcast@gmail.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.